Welcome to the Sci-Fi Fantasy Network. I'm Joel Corner, and my guest this week is Janet Varney. She is an Emmy-nominated actor, voice artist, musician, writer, producer, and dog owner. You probably know her from The Thrilling Adventure Hour, FX's You're the Worst, Stand Against Evil, and as the voice of Avatar Korra in The Legend of Korra. Janet, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Joel. I appreciate that you inserted dog owner, because it almost sounded for a second like maybe that was sci-fi fantasy oriented, and I started thinking, wow, what mystical beasts do I have that we call dogs?
Well, you know. You've got a polar bear dog, I assume, in real life.
Oh, gosh. One of my dogs is pretty close, for those people who have followed my occasional sporadic Instagrams of the dogs. One of them really is kind of alarmingly similar to Naga, and I've had him for 13 years, so he definitely predates Naga. It was a happy accident.
It has been just over 2 years now since The Legend of Korra ended. It's still a massive deal, attracts huge crowds to conventions. I mean, I was at New York Comic Con and couldn't get into the room where you were doing the panel. I turned up an hour early and it was full.
Oh my gosh, yeah, that was a fun one. That room was too small. I think that was something that Legendary that Dark Horse was thinking was, did we do the right size panel for this or room for this? And I was like, I don't might be a little small.
And that was introducing the comics. How much of the comics have you seen?
I haven't seen anything more than the rest of the world has seen. The stuff that, you know, we were kind of playing around with at the panel was just stuff that's since become available or has been out there for people to enjoy, and we gave away a bunch of, you know, just fun Avatar and Korra related books. The poster book was pretty new.
Oh yeah, it's good.
Or brand new, I think, when I was there, and that's just absolutely stunning. So I'm really glad they put that out there. So
having had the experience doing something that has such a big impact on people, yeah, how does that affect you, like, as a person and as an actor, like when you were playing the character, especially towards the book three and book four, when you knew it had this big audience that really, you know, got a lot out of it? Did that affect you as an actor, and did it affect you as a person?
Absolutely. I mean, I think as an actor, I don't know if it affected me too much, just because the means by which we record the show has always been the same. So it was very consistent. You're in a dark room, either by yourself or with other actors, when no one knows what it is or it hasn't been seen by anyone yet, and then you're in the same dark room after people have started watching it. So it would be amazing if you suddenly had to like go record it in a coliseum with a bunch of people staring at you. I'm really glad that's not the case. But so that stays real consistent, and that's just kind of a great environment that you can sort of disappear into when you're recording and just let your imagination kind of do the work for you, which the scripts are so beautifully written that even when you're recording it, you still kind of feel like it's all happening. So that's, you know, credit to Mike and Brian and the extraordinary staff of Nickelodeon and of our writing team. But as a person, it definitely affected me. You know, I think that doing that show and then doing my podcast, it was a total coincidence that they sort of both came into the world around the same time. And then I think right around that time, too, I had done Burning Love, and that sort of came out. And so that was sort of a little triumvirate of three things that I really personally loved and cherished. And they were also things that were very well received and so I was very vulnerable about all of them because I felt very close to all of them. And luckily they all were received really well. And they all had kind of a, you know, emotional impact on people more so than some other stuff I've done, even stuff that I've been really proud of that I've had a huge amount of fun doing. It's just a little bit different when you start getting feedback from people that is a little bit more emotional or, you know, just appreciative on the level of, you know, listen, this speaks to something I've gone through personally, or, you know, my daughter is going through this and it brought us closer together. Anything like that is, I always think of Bill Murray in Scrooged. I don't know if you've seen that movie, but when he, at the end, when he's sort of like manic because he's, you know, sort of the light bulbs come on and he's realized that he hasn't died and he's on set and he just goes off on his like amazing Bill Murray speech where he's like, you know, and once you have that feeling, once you get that feeling, you're greedy for it. You're going to want more and more. And that it's so true. I mean, on a very selfish level, it changes the whole way. It changed my My response to my own work, it changed my relationship to my work, because now I love doing stuff that's just frivolous and fun, but that sort of foundation that gets built underneath where you feel like you're doing something that is having a lasting impact on people or helping people in some way is it's just a very addictive feeling, because you feel like you're giving something back, or, you know, just that you're kind of contributing to the larger essence of like the arts in humanity, you know, in the given time. That sounds very grand, but you know, both my parents were teachers, and I watched the impact that they had on people's lives and how much it affected people going forward. And you know, my dad will have people, he's retired now, and he'll still have people who are like, Mr. Varney, you taught me in 1985 and you're the reason I became blank or whatever. So far, I don't think anyone said you're the reason I'm in prison, but so in general, like, it's just, I saw that impact that my parents had, and so I always, I think, have carried around a little bit of performer guilt, like, oh, all I do is this, like, is that enough? And so these things that happen, and I would say that Cora is really the, you know, the biggest anchor and certainly the most well-known, is those are those moments where you think, oh God, I'm so grateful that Mike and Brian pulled me into something that ended up affecting other people, because, you know, it would never have existed without them or Nickelodeon. I'm not the person who made it. I'm just the person who gets to sort of stand as an ambassador for it when I do cons.
You're in some ways the avatar of the show. Hey?
That's a really good point.
And a brilliant pun as well.
It's very meta. Yeah. Well done, my friend. Well done.
Speaking of the show having a big impact, of course, you know, the ending where Cora and Asami begin their relationship has had, you know, a big impact. It was, you know, all over the news, and I've started to notice other animated shows have taken a step towards more diversity in relationship, in representation, like Adventure Time, Steven Universe are two big examples I can think of. What's your view on the inside? Have attitudes been moving? Like, are things being made now that you would never have imagined possible when you were first starting out?
Within what's kind of being put out there creatively?
Yeah, what you're seeing, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was stuff before Cora, and it maybe didn't get as loud of a voice, and so I think the whole Avatar team felt really honored to be a part of something that felt like it was a watermark in some way. And I think, you know, the thing that I've probably said the most often, which is probably getting boring because I say it so often, but it is true, is that I think what's one of the really exciting things about it is that I look forward to, in a few more years, and certainly within, you know, a decade, of people looking back on what a big deal it was and going, God, isn't that crazy what a big deal it was? Like, it seems so silly that had to be a big deal, that we wouldn't have already crossed that threshold, and that it, you know, LGBT plus characters wouldn't just be a regular part of any form of entertainment, because it seems like such a no-brainer. That's the exciting feeling, is, you know, the same way that we look back on things when our, you know, for a mom to say, you know, oh God, no one got a PhD when I was in college. It was, you went to, you know, you're supposed to go to college to marry a man. Like, those things where we look back now and we're like, that's insane. I look forward to telling someone that story and them going, are you serious? Like, how close-minded, how crazy that it was like that it would even be a big deal.
What about the kinds of roles you're seeing coming up for women? I mean, like, have, like, female characters become more rounded and complex in more recent times compared to when, like I say, when you were first starting out?
I mean, I think they have. I think that's a good point. I think there have always been outliers where people have just really wanted to make the stuff that they want to make. And it's really hard to get through the cogs of the machine of show business because, you know, as much as even, you know, people who get a lot of grief, which is like television executives and stuff, many of them really want to do strange, new, different, you know, or complex stuff. And it's just, it's hard because it is a machine and there is a tremendous amount of money involved, and there's a lot of conservatism inside of that, even though the arts are also ostensibly where you get to be the most colorful and be the most loud and show people what the world is really like or what the world could be like. So I understand that it works the way it works for a reason, and it's always great when shows break through, like a Modern Family or, you know, and the Cora Asami bit and that kind of stuff. But I do think that in general, not just with women, but I think the sort of advent of the anti-hero, you know, thinking about shows like Breaking Bad or Nurse Jackie, some of the ones that were most noticeable because they were rolling out on pay channels around the same time. I think that's kind of helped overall, like in general, I think that roles are more interesting because we've seen the success in these characters, or like characters on Game of Thrones, characters that you're like, I don't know if I like or hate this person, but I can't stop watching them. And I think that really helped reshape what networks think people want to watch, because before then it would be sort of potentially kind of a bland family sitcom or, you know, something soap opera-y or just a crime procedural. And those things all still have their place. But I think that there has definitely been, especially with the internet and so many ways to get your content, we're seeing more and more, just like with Comic Cons, that you can kind of find what you're into somehow, somewhere. And some of it is very readily available, and they're making more and more.
I think, you know, people are also kind of, like you said, demanding better characters. Like, you know, perhaps, you know, is it the same for actors? Like, you do you find that being given a role that's just the wife, the girlfriend, the love interest, and that's kind of the only characteristic of that character, are actors becoming a bit more confident and saying, no, I think my character should be more than that?
I mean, I think that's a great question. I don't know the answer to that ultimately, because I know that I feel that way, but I also know that I have been doing this for a longer time, and so maybe I've either, you know, I certainly am not somebody that just gets an offer to do something. It's not like that at all. But my own pickiness, just by virtue of having been doing it for a while, has changed. I don't know that that's true of a newcomer. I don't know that any of us could afford to turn our nose up even as the love interest. But I hope that the general groundswell of people being more picky, even the ones that have louder voices than we do, somebody who is really famous who says, no, we should have better roles for women, like a Jennifer Lawrence or someone, then that is, there is a trickle down all the way to, you know, the young ingenue who's just gotten out of USC and is up for, you know, a really interesting dynamic role.
I have a question here from one of my fellow editors on the network, Rostia, who is a he's a theology student, as you might be able to tell by the question he's given me. He says Legend of Korra does have this spiritual side to it, as does Avatar. And you've talked about your quote-unquote spiritual feelings on the JV Club, your podcast, a couple of times. How much did you take away from Korra and Avatar in that regard? Because it is a central part of the story and the characters.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that a lot of what you see on that show is stuff that I am lucky enough to have been exposed to for one reason or another, which is, you know, I mean, of course, I was raised as either an atheist or a Mormon, depending on which parent you ask. But I think that certainly living in San Francisco and living in Los Angeles have afforded me, and Flagstaff, Arizona, to a certain degree, have afforded me the options around me of, hey, you know, this look at this religion over here, or look at this way of thinking, this sort of theology or even just philosophy over here, and look at all these different things and how are people benefiting from them, and is one of them absolutely right and one of them absolutely wrong? And that's one of the things that I like about the Legend of Korra and the Avatar universes, is that that's clearly true for Mike and Brian as well, that they've observed what we are exposed to in the real world and created some very similar kind of like a mirror world of certain spiritualities that leave open the possibility of a lot of different stuff. It's not just like one God with a beard. It's not, you know, this idea of like who the spirits are or why they exist isn't meticulously picked apart like in some sort of, you know, here's this book that explains why there's a magical mushroom or whatever.
A friendly
mushroom. And so, yeah. And so I like the idea of the sort of foregone conclusion that, that the spiritual world might even be as fraught as the regular world, but that there is more than we necessarily can see at any given time. And that even if your faith is in science, your faith in the science of not knowing everything yet, which is fundamentally kind of what science is based on in many ways, is still it feels still like a faith of a kind. Mm. And that's what I don't want anyone to feel like they can't have or needs to be taken away from them. They may be agnostic. They may be an atheist, a staunch atheist, and just believe in like random chaos. But I think that even if you just put, I think it's nice to have a faith in something. I think it's nice to stay optimistic about things. And I think optimism and faith are two sides of the same coin. Mm. And that it, even if it's just, I believe that, you know, this administration will, there will be a positive outcome, which is that people learn to flex their individual power or the state power or finding out the ways in which legislation can protect us in a way that maybe, you know, a president wouldn't at this point, that those wheels are turning and that there can be a positive outcome that that isn't necessarily this needs to stop right now and that's it. Like, that's not how the world works, really. And so I think that having the faith in the ability to face the present and find a way to work towards the future without feeling too cynical about it, while also still being, you know, safe and being sort of cautious, it sort of feels important for the human race. And I would include space travel with that. I think part of that is like, we got to get out there.
Mm. Well, speaking of religion, let's talk about improv comedy.
Sure, natural segue.
I'm an expert at segues. You've done improv comedy, and you're not the only Avatar alumni to have done so. It was Jack DeSena in the original series, PJ Byrne, and John Michael Higgins, and there's a lot of improv comedians in the Avatar universe. What do you think it is about improv? Does it like give you unique acting tools? Like, have you found, is it helpful just to get into character and stuff?
I think it's absolutely helpful. I think I would broaden the kind of calling out of improv actors in voiceover to, in Avatar and Legend of Korra, to a much larger swath of like animation in general tends to attract a lot of improv actors, or improv actors find they do well within it. And I do think that it has so much to do with, you know, you have less to work with, but it's true of on-camera actors too. If you can find this, if you can strike a balance between finding a way to express that you have a sense of understanding of the character that you're auditioning for, and that you have the flexibility to imagine a world outside of the words on the page while still being very respectful to those words, I think that does set you apart. And I think that that goes not just for auditioning and acting for actors, but for anybody who is interested in kind of broadening their social skills or wanting to think faster on their feet in some way. I think improv is a really good exercise. It's like when you tell people they want to be more physically flexible or more zen, that, you know, doing something like yoga that has these thousands of years of evidence behind it saying this really works. If you want to be X type of person, you should try X. And I think that that's true of improv. While it may not have that rich of a history or go back that far, I think that if you're willing to do that, you broaden your social skills and your own understanding of yourself and the way your brain works on some really fundamental levels. And you get better at empathizing with people. You feel more comfortable in situations in which you would feel shy. You feel more a part of a team and you trust people differently. So I always recommend it really to anyone.
Mm. When did you start with improv? I know it's something that's used in acting schools a lot. You did theater in high school, I understand. Were you doing improv games back then?
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing theater just in school from when I was in first grade, and there are always lots of exercises that I would characterize as improv. But what's funny is that I didn't do any improv comedy until I had finished, basically, I think either I was close to leaving school or I had left school. I never participated in any kind of fun improv gaming kind of teams like do exist for people of all ages. And I do wish that I would have. I wouldn't say that it's a regret, because I wouldn't change anything in the present, thus would not want to take the risk of changing anything in the past. But once I started doing it, I was like, oh my gosh, this is great. But I was definitely already in San Francisco when I was taking classes through the Bay Area Theater Sports program up there, and then came down here and did the UCB stuff. But also just playing around with friends in a more casual and relaxed atmosphere without even necessarily the intention of doing shows was just a wonderful way to spend the odd evening here and there.
I'm just getting a little bit conscious of the time, so I'm just going to skip forward sure. a few questions. Let's talk about Stand Against Evil, because that was the when I originally contacted you in December. it was just starting. It is now finished. I assume it's out there on the internet on IFC's website.
I think it's on iTunes too, and I'm sure it'll get to Netflix.
Is that just for people who are in the US of States, or is it everyone can get it there?
I think people have seen it elsewhere. That's a really good question, and you can probably also, if you want to get active, tweet IFC or the Stand Against Evil handle and find out more specifically, since I don't have that info right in front of me. But I do think that it should be watchable elsewhere. Gosh, I hope it is. I think it is on the app, but maybe I'm wrong.
It looks a lot of fun. I saw a couple of clips. I couldn't get any sort of legal download of it, but I saw some clips.
I'm not going to say anything if you somehow wanted to get your hands on it.
Things of questionable legality. But anyway, I've heard you talk about it, and it seemed to have quite a intense work schedule. You're doing 3-day shoots and things. Have the pressures on acting, has that become more intense as you've gone through the job?
It's, you know, the shooting that season was really intense for everyone, including, you know, just cast and crew and everybody, because we had a short time to do it. And it's a very physically active and effects heavy show in terms of practical effects. So it's not a whole bunch of stuff happening in post, which is what Dana Gould, who created the show and has a part in it and writes and is on, you know, on set present all day from the beginning to the end, what he wanted, because he is such a huge fan of kind of older school horror and sci-fi and stuff. And so it was definitely grueling. It was also the most action kind of stuff I've done in my career so far. I've done a few things here and there where I've had to do some pretty physical activity stuff, but this one is consistently physically taxing. But I loved it, and I really feel like it made me stronger on just a personal level, not just physically stronger, but kind of in terms of true grit, feeling like you can get through a tough day in terrible weather and still want to go to work the next day. It definitely, you know, the whole huge cliche of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Sometimes that's not true. Sometimes it's just like really hard. Even if it's something that you've survived, you still are like, don't give me that bullshit. But in this case, it was mild enough that it's true. I think I was very nervous going in about what my ability to have this kind of marathon runner endurance would be for the shoot, and the fact that I had it and I did it and I think we made a really good show is just makes me feel more confident in what I can do kind of across the board when it comes to endurance and stuff, and that I'm super grateful for.
And there's a season 2 coming, I understand.
Yeah, we're gonna start shooting it this summer.
Ooh, so you're jumping right back into it.
Let's do it.
You've also got a second series of one of my all-time favorite things, Neil's Puppet Dreams.
I hope so. You know, I might have spoken too soon when I said we're certainly working on it. I just don't know if it's going to get shot anytime soon. So I'm really hoping that comes to fruition sooner than later, because we have so many great ideas and such a wonderful plan of action to making that show happen. So fingers crossed. And thank you for liking it.
So what else have you got coming out? What's the next big thing you've got on the agenda?
I mean, I would say really shooting Stand Against Evil is looming large. I just finished as of Sketchfest, so I'm sort of pulling myself out of that hole of exhaustion, which is a wonderful hole, but it's very, very taxing. So I'm kind of bouncing back from that. And I think those are really, you know, that's sort of the in-between. I'm sure there will be some guest things that happen, hopefully, that I'll be able to do on TV before then. And my podcast, I try to do every single week. The one that just came out was live at SF Sketchfest and has John Hamm and Rachel Dratch and Matt Nathanson on it, and that was a ton of fun. So I hope to continue doing the JV Club on a regular basis.
The JV Club is genuinely good.
Thank you, Jill.
It really sort of informed my own interviewing style. I like this attitude you have of, you know, taking people's passions seriously. I quite like that.
Oh, good. excited. Oh, I'm very flattered.
So, where can people find you online? Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, etc.
Yeah, they can. The JV Club podcast is really the only place I have a Facebook presence. I mean, I certainly have a page and I post when I have friends who need me to promote stuff for them and stuff. But I'm in general not great about having a huge personal Facebook presence. But I am on the JV Club podcast page and I'm best on Twitter. I'm trying to reintegrate Instagram. My problem is that it's not that I'm an old lady. I'm actually okay technologically. I like to make fun of myself, but mostly I just hate being on a computer or on a device. I really like being in the world, looking people in the eye. So that's the thing I'm up against, but I'm trying to balance a little bit better with the people that I can't, you know, shake a hand with.
Well, if you want to shake virtual hands with Janet, you can probably find her online.
That's
somewhere.
Right. At Janet Varney is a good place to start on Twitter.
So, all that being said, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Back at you, Joel.
Yeah, because Avatar is one of my all-time... It's my Happy Place TV show whenever I'm feeling down.
So, I love that.
So, thank you. Thank you. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you so much, Joel.